You're listening to the Illuminaire podcast, where we dive deep into behavioral health topics and shine a bright light on the forces shaping this industry's future. From research and technology to business and investment and more. Here's your host, Dr. Ronit Molko.
Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Ronit Molko, and thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Illuminaire podcast. Today, we are talking about a very important and interesting topic, applied behavior analysis and autism. I am thrilled to welcome my guest, Bobby Rogers, to the Illuminaire podcast. Bobby is the director of Proud Moments Therapy in upstate New York. She's also the founder of Families for Effective Autism Treatment of Central New York. Feet of New York is a nonprofit agency that has provided support and services for families of children with autism for over 15 years. Bobby is also a board member of the New York State Association for Behavior Analysis and chair of NYSABA's Parent and Family. She is the co-creator of the Harmony in the Home Project, which provides intensive support for children with autism in Central New York. Bobby, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
I'm so excited that you're here. This is such an important topic. And before we dive into questions, I think we should explain a little bit about applied behavior analysis because not all of our listeners may know. So ABA, which is the acronym for applied behavior analysis, is a therapy based on the science of learning and behavior. ABA is widely used to treat autism, and it helps to increase language and communication skills, to improve attention, focus and social skills, and to decrease problem behaviors that interfere with daily functioning and learning. So, Bobby, please tell me a little bit about yourself and your son and how you entered this autism journey that you've been on.
So, I'm the parent of three children, and they are all teenagers and young adults now, which is really crazy. But that means that I've been in the world of ABA for 17 years, which seems like a crazy number of years. So my children are 21, 19, and 18, and my 19-year-old has autism, and he has some pretty severe symptoms of autism. And so we tend to really be defined a lot by some of those things, unfortunately. But what I will say is that it's really brought us to some awesome learning opportunities that I don't think we would have as human beings. So it's something we really embrace. And so ABA has been really essential for us. As a result of that, it kind of lent me into getting into the field of it from an administrative perspective. So I currently work for Proud Moments Therapy. We brought that to Syracuse, New York. We didn't have really a lot of accessible options for ABA here. That was the reason that we did that. But prior to that, in 2005, our family founded a nonprofit. And it's really a parent organization that's goal is to lift up parents. It's that simple. And we actually just changed our name. This week was the big announcement. And we're now referred to as Families First. It's just an updated name that really reflects who we are at this point. Our goal is simply just to lift each other up as families in whatever way that looks like. So I'm really proud of our nonprofit and everything that it's achieved. My son, Joey, is 19 and he's autistic, as I said, and he is the most authentic human being that I know. It's one of my favorite things about him. He is my truth teller. That's what we say about him. He loves numbers. He loves the number 8 and 3. So those are favorite numbers in our house. His favorite color is red. So I love it too. Actually, I think he's onto something there. And he's just an awesome human being. And my other two children, Lily and Matthew, I love that they've been siblings to this journey. I think that that has made them extraordinary human beings as well. So autism is something I really love talking about, but so is ABA, because of all of the things that applied behavior analysis has given to our family. So I'm really grateful to be here, and I'm grateful to talk about both applied behavior analysis, autism, and also what it's like when you're parenting a child who is profoundly affected by autism, because I don't know if, you know, I've always been great about talking about that side of things. I've always kind of leaned into the celebratory conversations. So I'm excited to have those opportunities today.
And that's such an important conversation to have. And I'm so appreciative that you're here and willing to speak about that, because that's not a conversation that happens out in the open very often. And I think it's really important because parents who are living that every day need that support and need that voice and need that awareness in the community. So thank you for doing that.
It's not something I'm great at. That's the part I'm still getting better at, is talking about that piece. It tends to be the least smooth conversation I have of all of them, but I'm grateful for everyone's patience as I do that more and more. I think it's important. I want all families to feel visible, and I want to be a part of making that happen. So I'm attempting to get braver with it.
Yeah, and that's so honest and vulnerable. So thank you for sharing that. So, you know, to start off with ABA, I mean, ABA has been around for a long time. It's not only used in autism, it's used in many other areas. ABA is used in marketing, it's used in sports, it's used in lots of areas, but we hear about it mostly in autism. And there is some controversy around it. You know, some people really don't like ABA. A lot of autistic self-advocates have come out saying that they don't like ABA. So I'd love to hear from you, you know, what was good and what was helpful and what worked, as well as, you know, what didn't work or what was missing in your ABA services?
So this is such a great question, because there is a lot of conversation from people who aren't advocates for ABA. And so if I'm a parent and I'm looking for information, there's a lot of conflicting stuff out there. And so the more that we talk about what was good and what didn't work, the more we can really give information to the people that need it, which are our parents. So I love this question. My favorite part of ABA and what it's done for us is really just gifts of things that the rest of us take for granted. I think of Joey and how he lives his life. Sometimes it's hard to watch somebody that you love so much have to earn things the rest of us take for granted. So simple things like dignity, independence, privacy in the bathroom, certainly communication. Those are things that he has to earn. I wish that were different, of course, as his mom, but I'm glad that there's something that helps us, you know, give those to him so he can have the same things as all of us. I don't think there's any 19-year-old that wants his mom to help him in the bathroom. So, you know, ABA is what gave us the tools to work through that so that he could be independent in the bathroom. For us as parents, you know, we can see nonverbal behavior and we can see emotions as his language. And that has really opened up an avenue for us to understand Joey so much better. And that's what I want more than anything, is I want him to feel understood, especially by the people that love him so much. So ABA has given us those things. Interestingly enough, I feel like ABA has helped us the most as it relates to building skills. I think when people think of ABA, they think a lot about minimizing problem behaviors. That's the first thing that people think of when they think of ABA. But for us, my favorite parts of what it's done for us is actually related to skill acquisition and teaching him things that, you know, have really changed his life. He is independent in the bathroom. That's huge. Like, I can't say that enough. I can't imagine how it would feel to him if he wasn't and he needed my help. I also, you know, love that it does work on behaviors too, because I don't want there to be an impediment to him doing the things he wants to do. So, you know, like if he's got aggression or self-injury, you know, obviously we want to work on that because we don't want him hurting himself or anybody else. But I also want to work on anything that needs to happen that will, you know, prohibit his ability to be whatever he wants to be. So, you know, we certainly use it for that as well. In terms of what didn't work well for ABA, he does have aggressive behaviors we weren't able to figure out, which is the ironic thing to say about what didn't work, because that's, again, what people love. But it didn't, you know, there were some that we weren't able to figure out. And that's been difficult as he gets bigger, of course. It's more and more difficult. And some of the self-injury stuff we weren't able to figure out either. So he still has a lot of that stuff. I think the other piece too, coming from where I live, there wasn't a lot of options to get ABA. It wasn't available in schools. It actually still isn't for the most part. So there wasn't consistency. Yeah, isn't that? I just talk to other people sometimes from other states and it's so different. But I guess that's the country we live in. It is different. wherever you live, it's a different dynamic, but there wasn't consistency. So, and we still have that issue now, honestly, where there's certain things that he's learned in school that, you know, aren't generalized other places and vice versa. So currently, for the last 2 years, he does have a program in school and they are using applied behavior analysis there, but they haven't, we don't have all of that information all of the time to generalize it. So, and they're an amazing team. We're all getting there. They're super awesome. I can't say enough about how lucky we are to have this team of really compassionate people, but consistency is always an issue. And so where I live, at least, and I think that keeps it from working as well as it could. It's really hard if everybody's doing something different. And I would say that's been a huge piece that we've had to advocate for, that everywhere Joey goes, you know, that we're doing these things so it makes sense to him and it works. And that hasn't always really worked. And I think across various parts of this country, that's a fact for a lot of people, that you might have, you know, an ABA approach here, but not there. Not everybody knows what we're working on. That's confusing for kids like Joe, for individuals to have different messages, particularly, like I said, he relies on, you know, we rely on nonverbals and emotions as his language and communication. So we have to really look at what we're doing as caregivers working with him and making sure that we're all doing the same thing in a way that makes sense to him.
You know, you bring up such an important point, and I hear this a lot from parents, that there's a lack of collaboration between team members to get the school piece, the home piece, the OT, the speech therapist, you know, everybody to kind of collaborate together. So there is that consistency. What are your ideas around developing stronger partnerships between families that you're serving, ABA clinicians, and then all the related therapies?
So I think when people talk about this, they're always looking for this recipe, and it's less of a recipe in my mind. From my perspective as a parent looking into the field, I feel like it's more about just humility. So sometimes I hear in the field, people talk about cultural humility, and I love that we're talking about that. But I think even broader, it's family humility as well. So understanding each dynamic of each family, like we all have our own culture, and understanding, you know, that you have to go into every single situation and try and learn specifically what works for that family. But also it's about humility as it relates to other disciplines too. So we certainly have had, you know, meetings for Joey, school meetings, where there were people that walked into the room already, you know, having decided whether they agree with somebody else. And they hadn't met that person yet. So it was discouraging to be on the other end of that, to have one person, because maybe they were a behavior analyst, or one person, you know, that was, you know, had a different, you know, role on Joey's team, and they didn't always agree with each other. And I felt as a parent, sometimes that had been decided before we even got into the room, and that only hurts Joey in the end. So it was definitely difficult to watch that. I don't think that happens everywhere. Again, you know, there's such a difference, where you are and what people believe and what their philosophy is, but it makes a difference when everyone's sitting at the table. So I always just say, I think that there isn't a recipe except for humility. And that if you walk into a room and you assume that you're already the smartest person in the room and you have the most to add, then we aren't going to be effective. But if we assume that other people have information that we can borrow and learn from, whether it's the parents, whether it's, you know, another team member in whatever role that they have, then I think we're going to get to the place that we need to be for collaboration. You know, there's speech therapists that have done amazing work with my son that I love. And some of them, you know, agreed with ABA and some didn't. Likewise, I've had, you know, multiple over the 17 years of, you know, being involved in ABA, had behavior analysts that were more or less willing to collaborate with our speech team. And that's true of all of the disciplines. I picked speech because I think most of us, have that for our child, but it's true across the board. So I just think it's humility. I actually am pretty encouraged. I don't know how you feel about this, but I feel like this year I've heard a lot more about compassionate care, collaboration, and, both cultural, family humility, and all of these things. So I'm really optimistic about where we're at with that. And I think behavior analysts are very compassionate and kind human beings as a rule. I really do.
Yes, I think I agree with you. I think there's much more of a conversation around it, along with the conversation around diversity and inclusion. I think we're just hearing a lot more around the focus on culture and real sensitivity around individual, as you say, family culture, not just, you know, culture in terms of where you come from or your ethnicity or your religion, but more around each family has a way of doing things. And if you bring in a technique or a strategy that you're trying to get a parent to use that doesn't align with their philosophy, their parenting philosophy and their family culture, it's not going to land well. And I think that's another piece of the humility that you're talking about, right? I've certainly spoken to parents who've said, you know, I was asked to use time out didn't match my parenting philosophy. It wasn't something I was going to do. And so there needs to be a humility around, you know, adjusting and being flexible to match, you know, the parenting philosophy and the ecosystem of the family.
Yeah. I think even sometimes when I look at the language that we use in the field, I'm always wondering if we've really thought about how that's received. We talk about, you know, that there's this anti-ABA culture. And I, you know, look at some of the language and I look at the fact that we still use words like aversive. Okay, if we don't want people to think that we're aversive, then maybe we should look at that and change that. And, you know, even negative reinforcement, I understand it isn't negative, but it's got the word negative right in it. Or, you know, when someone says, oh, we're going to take data on your child, in my mind, like as a parent, like if I didn't know what ABA was, I'd think of all these people in white coats surrounding my child and like observing him like a science experiment. I think we just really need to do a better job at looking at the language. One of the things I noticed about you is you call parent training parent support. And I love that because I dislike the idea of parent training. It makes it sound like we're training people to be a parent and we've kind of figured that out. And so, you know, we're really training something completely different. It's about progress monitoring for your child. It's about collaboration. You know, we could call it parent collaboration. I ask people in the field a lot of times, I pick their brain to see what they call it. That's how I remembered that you call it parent support, actually. That's one of my things that I do. A couple of my favorites is Dr. Noor Saeed in SUNY Empire. She says progress monitoring, which I love. Mm-hmm. And then my good friend, Dr. Bobby Newman, he's the one that gave me the parent collaboration meeting idea. So I love all of those. And I love giving like all those options to people so we can get rid of parent training altogether and never use that again. But some of the harder stuff to change, like punishment, aversive, and I get we don't talk about them frequently, but they still exist everywhere. I wish when we're thinking about, you know, humility and family culture, and we can also think about how we're talking, you know, as a field and what is the language that we're using, because it's certainly not parent friendly.
Yeah, I've always been sensitive to that. I mean, when I was, you know, a new BCBA, a new psychologist going into parents' homes, the idea that I was training them to be a parent when I didn't have my own kids just didn't land. And so, you know, the idea that a young person who doesn't have as much parenting experience is training this parent who's dealing with a child with autism to be a parent just doesn't, you know, it doesn't land. So I think parent support, being respectful to parents in that way, makes a lot more sense. When my daughter was in first grade, any work that they didn't finish during class would be put in a box called unfinished work. And every Friday they'd come home with the unfinished work. And it was such a demoralizing thing for a 5 or a 6 year old. And I said to the teacher, can't we call this work in progress? You know, why does it have to be labeled unfinished? Because every week she would come home with the things, you know, and just felt so bad about herself that she hadn't finished them, as opposed to, you know, we're just in progress. And when we finish it, everyone goes at their own pace. And when we finish it, we finish it. So I think those semantics are really important.
Yeah, I do too. One of the things I love about the field is that it is always evolving. We've come so far. So, you know, that is a conversation I've heard other people have, not just myself, wherever I go. I've heard other people talking about it too. So, you know, again, that's, you know, I love this field. I love how we grow all the time. We're always talking about things. And I hope this is one of the next things that we really look at.
Bobby, you've talked quite a bit about goal setting. What are some of the really important things to remember about goals, you know, when you're setting goals for a program?
Oh, this is such a big piece of whether we get all of this right. I think it has to be quality of life. And when I think about goals, that for me is, it's a personal and almost an emotional thing, because it is so important and it matters so much. I, you know, sometimes say that I hear parents talk about how if they could, you know, get into their child's head, and think about what it feels and be able to know what it feels like to be them for a day and how, you know, they think and know, you know, what they want to say, like all those things that as the parent of a child who doesn't have a lot of language, we don't feel like we know. Sometimes I just want to understand Joey and I just want to be him for a day so I see how the world feels. And I used to think that all the time. And so many parents say that all the time to me. But if I really think about it, I actually don't want to be in his head for a day. I think I would be nervous. I don't know if my heart could take it. I feel like so much of his day, we are, you know, misunderstanding him and he's feeling misunderstood. And just the memories that I think about for him that I know I got wrong, you know, times when I misunderstood him, are so difficult for me to just get through. Like one time in particular that, you know, is always in my head, when he was in elementary school and he was crying in the morning, I thought, okay, he doesn't want to wear his new shoes. We're going to work through this. We're going to push through. And I put him on the bus. And then about an hour later, I got a call from the school where he had gotten sick and I had to go pick him up. And I picked him up and then I just cried the whole way home because I thought, how did this beautiful child feel not being able to even tell his mom that he was sick? It was just heartbreaking to think of that and how isolating and lonely that moment must be for him. And he was a baby. I mean, he was young, elementary school, tiny little thing. And to have that be part of what you have to navigate all by yourself without the language to sit and say to your mom, I had a bad day and someone made fun of me or this happened or that happened. Like, I don't get to do those things with him. And that can be really hard. And so when I think about the times that, you know, he said, you know, he wanted a cheeseburger and I thought he said chicken or all of those things, the ones that I know about are already so hard to get through. It's some of the hardest parts of this, that the idea of being in his head and knowing how many times in one day does this poor kid have people not understand or he can't say, my head hurts. It took us a long time a year ago to figure out he had a cavity and it was really bad and it definitely we thought, oh, he's got allergies, his head hurts, you know, he kept saying head. And by the time we got it fixed, I don't know how long he was like that. It was terrible. So I don't think that my mommy heart can take being in his head for a day. But the thing about Joe is that he is so awesome. I'm just like in awe of this human being because I think I would be bitter. I think I would wake up and be angry at the world all the time. And he wakes up and he just gives us all a second chance every day. I can't even believe it sometimes. I'm just so in awe of somebody who has that perspective on life and got it on his own. Like, I didn't teach him that. He did that. That's him. That's who he is. It's amazing to be the parent of somebody like that. Like, it's just amazing. I'm in awe of it. But he wakes up every day and he gives us a second chance. So for me, I feel like if Joey can do that and if he can wake up every single day and say, all right, I'm giving you another chance, we have a responsibility to do everything we can to get it right. He's giving us another chance, but his life is too important for us to miss out on that second chance. So if we have the opportunity to develop goals, then I would rather that we not work on things like having Joey say colors. How about we practice saying juice box so that he's not thirsty all day at school because he couldn't just say water or juice box. I'd rather someone teach him that. That's going to help his life. And that's going to keep him from being misunderstood and being independent and being exactly who he wants to be in that moment. And I don't care if he ever knows the 50 states. I really don't care. Just teach him recreational skills so that he can do what he wants to do all day long. That's what I want for him. You know, and if we're reducing a problem behavior, is it a problem for him or for us? Because it's got to be about his quality of life. That's what it has to be about. And so I'm kind of a stickler, and this is a real huge thing for me. It's probably my biggest thing is, what are we working on? And are we wasting his time? Because every day this kid gets up and navigates this world that isn't built for him in a way that's, you know, works well for him. And he does it anyway. And he's not bitter. He's kind. He's awesome. And so we don't get to say, well, you know, I'm tired today, or, well, I'm going to use this curriculum because I already built it for another kid. Or we need to understand that individual, what works for them, what will help their quality of life, and make sure that every single thing that we do goes back to that one motivation.
That's so beautiful, Bobby, and it's so well said. I mean, I think I've looked at a lot of programs across the country, and there's some that are doing an awesome job, and there's some that are just focusing on what are these developmental milestones that every child has to hit to look like the typical 6-year-old or to look like the typical 8-year-old. But as you say, if thought is not put into what's going to make this individual as independent as possible, you know, in a way that provides them with a fulfilled life where they are happy, where they can communicate their needs, where they can get their needs met, where they can have dignity and they can have privacy and they can have the kind of life that they want. You know, we really have to think about, what are we teaching them and how does this serve them in the future? And I think that's a big, big lesson and really important for the ABA community to hear, because there are a lot of programs out there that are very limited and are kind of looking at, how do I get this child to look like the typical first grader? You know, so we can move them into a typical classroom, which might be a great milestone, but how does this inform their life? And as you say, every single day, and getting their needs met, it's such an important piece.
And I think that if people stopped and really thought about what a day looked like for someone else, we would get there naturally. I think we just forget to do that. It's like we get in academic mode or something, and we're all thinking about, you know, the list that we know. But if we really thought about what someone's day looks like, I feel like we'd get there. I feel like if people understood, okay, how many times really, you know, does Joey feel misunderstood? How many times did he get made fun of and he couldn't tell someone about it? And how many times was it just that the room was too noisy and a simple environmental change would have made the difference to whether or not he could stay in that setting or not? So I feel like there's so much that can be accomplished if we really hone in on what it is. I wish that every single time that we write a goal that we had to, and we're forced to in some way, justify why this helps that person's quality of life. I wish for a while we implemented that as some mandatory requirement so that people just got in a habit of thinking this way. Because I think it's just habits that we have to change. And some people do a great job too. I don't want to sound like every single person that's ever worked with Joey in the field. Like, this is a great, the reason I love this field and am in this field is because these are all conversations people are open to having. But I do wish we could almost make it mandatory for a while so people had to think about it.
And as you say, are we eliminating behaviors because they make us uncomfortable? And it may just not, that just may be a waste of time. You know, it may make us uncomfortable, but actually it either serves the person in some way, or it's actually not that important to eliminate it. It's much more important to teach a skill that's right. Helpful. Right. And where are we spending our time?
Mm-hmm. I totally agree. Yep.
You spoke a little bit earlier about the difficulty around speaking about, you know, your experience in the journey and what it's like to be parenting a child that's severely impacted by autism. What would you like to share about that?
So I think part of it is that all of us like to talk about the celebrations as human beings. That is something we discuss regularly. We like it. It's reinforcing. People like hearing about it. It is tough to talk about the severe stuff. Even the word severe is not always really well received. I think some people, you know, don't want to say that word. And I understand where people are coming from because it's different for everyone. And I don't want to start, you know, having somebody else whose journey is different than what my son's look like have to advocate even harder to get heard for their version of autism. The problem is, I always go back to, you know, who is Joey? And, you know, as his parent, I've spent so much time talking about the celebrations. And then I think about, he is, like I said, the most authentic person I know. And he's also my truth teller. And am I representing who he is if I'm only talking about a portion of what his life is like, only the best of it. And the other thing that I keep going back to is the idea that in the space of a day, again, there's so much that he has to navigate. So he isn't someone that is mildly affected at all, not even close. Like everything that he does throughout the space of the day is affected in some way by some symptom. He has a difficult time in a crowded room. Crowded can be three people sometimes for him. He has a difficult time with noises, sleeping, eating. All of that is stuff this individual who I fiercely love has had to work through. So if I don't really talk about how much was in the way of his success with those things, am I really doing justice to who he is, or am I diminishing, again, the best part of him? Like I said earlier, he wakes up every single day and there's not an ounce of his resentment or bitterness towards the world. He just has this beautiful, kind heart. And so I almost want to talk about how difficult it is for him, because he has all of this. And then he wakes up every day, forgives everything that we got wrong. I mean, who lives their life that way? Like, who is that forgiving? I don't know anybody. Like, I know people who are still holding a grudge over some silly, someone took their parking spot. Like, and this kid, he like goes through so much in a day and we get so much wrong and he still just loves us fiercely. And I think I could do pretty much anything and the kid would wake up the next day and be like, it's all right. You know, it doesn't matter that you murdered our neighbor. Don't worry about it, Mom. Let's just watch this show. Or let's, like, it's the coolest thing about him. I don't want to not say that he is severely affected, because he is. And not only is he severely affected by his autism, but he wakes up every day and is the single most forgiving human being I know, the most authentic human being. All of us are worried about these tiny personality flaws and who's going to know that we messed up here or we didn't say this exactly right. And this kid is like struggling for basic language and he wakes up every day and he's like, okay, we're going to do this again. I mean, I can't even believe it sometimes, really. And I don't hear people talking about it. And I'm always like, how are we missing the best part of, you know, people? How are we missing that there's so many great examples of authenticity, what really good living looks like if we look at the autistic community? Like, it's amazing to me that we're missing this giant learning opportunity for all of us who worry about these small things. And then someone like Joey is just like, hey, you know, it's all right that you did that. It's all right that you messed up on that. You had no idea what I was talking about yesterday. Don't worry about it, Mom. Like, it's the coolest part of it. So I think that we have to allow people to say when it's hard. Hard is not sad. Hard is not without joy. We need people who say that their child or they are severely, profoundly, significantly affected by autism. That's okay to say too, because really what matters is this awesome ability to wake up every day and do this again. It's profound. That's the most profound thing. That's the piece that we have to get. And so, you know, I'm trying to be braver because it is who Joey is and what he's taught me. He's taught me to be authentic. He's taught me to be forgiving. He's taught me to be vulnerable. So I'm trying to do a better job, but it isn't always well received. And I almost wish everybody could just see how beautiful it is, because then I feel like maybe it would be.
And why do you think it's not well received? Does it make people uncomfortable?
That's part of it. Definitely, I think some people that have kind of seen some of Joey's struggles are uncomfortable when they see it. I think it's one thing to hear it. Seeing it is different. But even when you're talking about it in a way that's really visual, I think it's hard for people. But I also feel like we now are in a place where autism is defines so many different versions. I don't know how else to say it, but you know, if I'm talking about Joey and all of his struggles and really going into, you know, detail about what it looks like for him, and then there's somebody else who's describing their autism and how, you know, they're married with a great job and it allows them, you know, to focus better on the things that they love, and these are all the great things, and you know, maybe somebody else is like, wait, I thought autism was this. And so it's harder for them to feel like their journey is visible and that they're validated. I think sometimes we're calling everything autism, and that makes it harder for people to feel seen. And so, you know, when people aren't feeling seen, you know, maybe everyone's just trying to talk louder than the next person. I'm not entirely sure. I only know from my perspective that I feel like when we've spoken about Joey's symptoms, we definitely have gotten a lot of pushback. In fact, in some presentations that I've done, I was asked to remove parts where we talked about his aggression and to do the presentation without that stuff. They said it would make people uncomfortable and that it would give people a bad impression of what autism was. And the, you know, the first time that I was asked to do that was about 8 or 9 years ago, and I did it. And then I felt so terrible after for a million reasons that I never did that again. It was, this is what I'm saying. This is who we are. And if I'm not the right speaker, I'm not the right speaker. But I think it's a combination of things. And from what we've seen and what we've experienced, it's both a comfort level. And it's also so many people are trying to feel seen and validated and understood. And it looks so different. I'm not sure if it's all working for us all to feel that way while we're all talking. And some people are trying to talk louder than the other.
Yeah, that's a really interesting perspective. You know, from my experience, when I entered the field, I was working much more with the profoundly impacted individuals. You know, we weren't really, I think, identifying individuals who we now call, you know, label, for lack of a better term, low support, or individuals who, you know, we used to use the term higher functioning. We don't use that term anymore, right? But those individuals are not really identified. So I've had both sides of the conversation. I've had conversations with parents who don't like the neurodiversity movement because they feel like it ignores the individuals that are more severely impacted. And then the individuals who don't like, you know, who feel like this emphasis on what autism is really dismisses a lot of individuals who don't need as much support. And therefore, you know, people look at them and go, well, you don't really have autism, even though they have a lot of struggles with anxiety, depression, sensory issues. You know, they're kind of dismissed as not needing support. So there's kind of those both sides of the conversation. And I think it must be very confusing for the general public who's not well-versed to understand, like, how can this be autism and how can that be autism? And, you know, as you say, it's each side feels invalidated by the other side's definition. So I think it's definitely challenging. But I really appreciate you expressing that, because I think parents, you know, I've spoken to quite a few parents who are like, you know, we just don't go out, or we stay at home, or we just don't go to social events because we don't want to be judged in that way. So I really appreciate you sharing what that's like.
Yeah, I think you're so right. And you said it so well. And I do think, you know, part of what our family collectively made a decision to start being more honest about some of the challenging parts of this journey. And when we did, part of why we said we really wanted to be braver and to start doing this was because I felt like, as a family who is a little more public where we live because of our nonprofit, the more that I didn't talk about it, the more invisible I think I inadvertently made certain families feel. So our journey was public enough for families to know that we were dealing with a lot of challenges. And yet when I would be speaking, I'd be talking about this great thing and that great thing while they were like struggling. And I wasn't talking about the tearful moments. I was talking about, you know, the joyful ones, and it wasn't fair to them. It just took me a little while to figure it out. And then I think when so many people were saying, we don't want to hear that part of it, it did make me feel like, okay, maybe this is what I should be doing. I should just be talking about the celebrations. And it isn't easy to talk about the other stuff anyway. As Joey's parent, I stumble every time I'm trying to talk about that stuff. It doesn't come out smooth like it does when I talk about how awesome he is. I just say that, just comes right off top of my tongue. But when I talk about the challenging stuff, I am like stopping and I'm thinking and it's just choppy. And that's because it's emotionally extremely difficult to talk about. And then when it's not well received, and then you have to defend why you talked about that, that's even harder. I love that we have groups now that allow space for that, that are built just for that conversation of some of the more challenging pieces, because then it's a nice safe space for parents to do that. that's a nice evolution that's happened in the autism world. And I love that. I wish everybody could talk about their journey. Maybe we're back to that humility thing again, where we have to have that towards each other as caregivers and individuals. I don't know what it's like to have a child who's, you know, verbal and also behavioral. How is that received by the world? I can't imagine. People can look at Joey and in 30 seconds know that there's something going on there. And there is some protection that is allowed to him for that and some forgiveness for what might happen out in public. I don't know how it feels to be other people. I don't know how it feels to be misunderstood when you do have, you know, a wonderful job and you're doing so well, but you still feel so misunderstood and not heard. I don't know how that feels. And I don't want anyone out there to feel that way. I want them to talk. I just think sometimes we're hurting people already hurting, and all this conversation is people's pain that we're hearing about. And rather than get angry at someone who's mad at me for talking about, you know, saying that Joey's severe, you know, or saying that this is hard, I just try to remember that it's pain that I'm hearing on the other end. And that allows me to do what Joey's taught me, really wake up tomorrow and do what I need to do to be authentic and forgive whatever happened yesterday if someone was upset with me, and just move forward.
So Bobby, you mentioned earlier about Joey's siblings and how, you know, what this journey's been like for them and how this has really helped them grow. Being a sibling is really difficult often because there's so much focus on the autistic child that, you know, often the siblings kind of fall by the wayside or have to be in a support role all the time, right, for this individual. And a lot of your family life is defined by what this individual needs. So what's it been like for Joey's siblings? And can you share a little bit about how this has informed their growth?
So when I think about Lily and Matthew and I think about who they are, the thing about them is everything that we as parents have tried to teach them with words, they learned by living. And what's awesome is when I look at who they've chosen to be friends with, it's all people that are really kind, wonderful, huge morals, the type of kids you would want your child to be friends with. We didn't say, pick that kid to be friends with. And we didn't tell them, make sure you treat everybody the same. They just did that and got it. We don't have to work as hard to make sure that we're demonstrating that to them. They've lived it and they understand it. No one, I think, felt more what it was like to have a brother who was in the same school district who got picked on or who, you know, was misunderstood. I was talking about how it felt to be us, but I can't imagine how it felt to be his siblings and to hear what other people said. And so that was very difficult for them. But what ended up happening out of that journey are these really intuitive human beings with such great empathy and a way to live this life in such a broad way where they open themselves up to any opportunity. It's really amazing to see what our siblings are able to gain from this journey. And they're definitely a testament to that. I think they're two awesome and amazing human beings. The one thing I would say that might be difficult that warrants a conversation isn't just the fact that they had to grow up with a brother who had behaviors that, you know, we're impediments to their lives, whether we like saying that and like being honest about that, that's true. You know, Joey would just disrobe. And so Lily couldn't have friends over. And, you know, he was aggressive and sometimes they got hurt. I don't know how it felt for the kids to watch when Joey was aggressive towards their mom. My son, Matthew, definitely struggled with watching that and feeling helpless, like he couldn't do anything about it. Those are really difficult moments that warrant conversation. They don't just have the burden of worrying about their brother or trying to walk through what it felt like for them, but also their parents too. I mean, I'd like to say that I handled everything great, but let's be real. Like, they lived with me and there were times that I was crying over something and they knew and they watched their mom cry, or times that my husband and I weren't on the same page. They're living with us. You know, we tried to do the best we could with that, but they're smart and they knew. And that's a lot for the siblings to take on. But the silver lining is all of those experiences just created these beautiful human beings who I think their lives are just going to be so much richer from having the cumulative effect of all of these experiences and seeing what a beautiful life really can be, even when it's so different from everybody else.
And that brings us back to compassion, right? Which is so important in this field, in everything, and in this field as well.
Yeah. Yep. And look who we have to teach us that. Like I said, it just goes right back to, you know, the autistic community. There's so much for us all to learn.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Bobby. This has been so beautiful and so vulnerable. And I think just so important for people to hear because, you know, we haven't had certainly, you know, even on the professional side, we don't get a lot of access to really hearing people share about their journey in this way. And I think it's so informative and so important for people to hear. And I really, really appreciate you being so open and so transparent and sharing with me and with all of our listeners.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for your wonderful questions.
Thanks for listening to the Illuminaire Podcast with Dr. Renit Molko. If you like what you heard today, please subscribe, rate, review, and share our show with other listeners. See you next week.